Good morning, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, Minister Patel, those of you that haven't seen each other for some time, can you allow us to start the meeting? Afterwards, you can invite each other for lunch. Parliament has got three nice restaurants. There's a couple of restaurants outside of Parliament as well. So you can invite each other for lunch, and then you can have a healthy discussion over lunch for about an hour. As you heard, the bells were rung. That is, excuse me, the NA bells, National Assembly. So the minister will have to do the briefing and be with us for some time, and then he'll have to go back to the National Assembly, as they are also voting on legislation today. So without wasting time and all that, I want to start and say welcome, Minister, and thank you for taking the time out to come and do the briefing personally to the committee. This is one department where we can also always say that we are pleased to have you in our midst to lead from the front, yourself and the DG, Madam Schreiner. We are very happy to have you as well as Parliament Legal Services, as well as the State Law Advisor, our staff, everybody knows everybody in the room. Is that correct, Honorable Flamingham? It's not correct. So you want to introduce yourself?
No, I'm happy to be with you.
But Honorable Ngube wants to introduce herself, so we're gonna allow her that opportunity and space in each one. Let's do the introduction as soon as possible. Leave your status, whether you are married or divorced, or like the Honorable Nyambi said, status always. Married, his status is MBA. His status is MBA, married but available, Minister. So we can leave that for the time being. My name is Freddie Adams, permanent delegate from the Western Cape. Let me start the side.
My name is Dinke Ngobe, a new member of this committee, from a permanent delegate from Gauteng. Thank you, Chairperson.
My name is Veronica Selin Kekesi, from the North West Legislature, permanent delegate. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning. My name is Dave Abrams, and I'm from Gauteng. Thank you.
Good morning. I am Elsa Finlingen from the Eastern Cape.
Morning, Bob Nalinguni, Free State.
Morning, Jomo Nyambi, Mpumalanga Province.
I'm Andrew, and I'm from PNG.
Good morning, I'm Herman Smith from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
I'm Shamara Ali, Procedural Advisor in COP.
Good morning, Jenny Schneider, Economic Development.
Good morning, everyone. Ibrahim Patel, Minister of Economic Development.
Morning. I'm Ludo Musashuba, Colonial Advisor for the Committee.
Good morning. I'm Ludo Musashuba, Colonial
your name and address, so ID number, date of birth. Okay. Now we know who's who, so tomorrow when we're reading the papers, Minister, we can put a name to say the papers quote and a reliable source has said so and so. Colleagues, as you know, this legislation before us which the minister will produce to us now. It's the 76th legislation. And I want to, from the outset, thank the colleagues that went to the provinces. Some of the briefings will be done tomorrow in the provinces, in the respective provinces. And Minister and DG has already assigned officials, senior officials, to go and accompany us whenever we go to our briefings in our provinces. Please, colleagues, see that you are there to take charge of the briefing, if possible and when possible. Provinces has indicated that they are waiting for this legislation because this legislation will just further enhance other pieces of the puzzle that needs to be put together, as the Minister will now explain to us. So we don't want, please, from your side, any delay. Provinces has indicated that they are ready. So if there's a delay, it will only be on your side. So, and I know that you are quite capable, and you're quite capable, and you have got the drive as honorable members to see that we do as our provinces request us to do. Minister, you and the DG and your staff, thank you also for crafting such a wonderful piece of legislation where we can tie everything together, where nothing is at loose ends and strings anymore. And also with this legislation, we've got a visitor here, someone that has frequented the committee but has thrown the committee away, Herman from the Herman from the State Law Advisor. Thank you that you could bring him along, Minister. He was quite a good friend of the committee, but welcome back, Herman. Really welcome. Minister, without further ado, we want to hand over to you and DG to take us through. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for that introduction to the topic. Honourable members will know that this is the first piece of legislation that is coming before the select committee from the Economic Development Department, although this legislation now, this draft legislation now, no longer belongs to us. It now belongs to Parliament, but it's been referred from the National Assembly. And what I propose to do is to really build on the dialogue that we've had in the Select Committee over the last few years on development and on infrastructure, and try to show both what the legislation that the committee is required to consider seeks to do and how it fits in with the overall infrastructure thinking of government. Infrastructure, I should say at the start, is one of those areas where every political party is of the same view, that it's necessary, that it's an area that the country needs, and that where we can build a cross-party consensus in Parliament and in the society. Now, we've prepared an extensive PowerPoint presentation. It's got some 45 slides, and I propose not to go through each slide in considerable detail, but there are some that I would like to spend a bit of time on to take the members of the committee through what it is that is this package that is before the committee and that the provinces will have to consider. So using this as the inspiration then, I'm going to use the screen, but there are printed copies of the presentation that members have, and may I apologize to the start, Chairperson, that as a result of the presidential youth indaba, I was only able to sign off yesterday on the final version, and so I'm really sorry that we were not able to give it to committee members earlier. I hope we can make up for it by spending a bit of time on the areas that are more relevant. But because this summarizes a bill that committee members would have received, it really just puts into PowerPoint form the basic bill itself. So I start by way of Residential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission was established in 2011, and it began its work on infrastructure rollout immediately. And based on that successful experience, actually doing something in Texas, seeing what works, the PICC identified the need for us to have a clear legal framework. So we did that by way of a decision of the President and Cabinet, and as it became more and more successful, everybody started to say, well, shouldn't we capture this in a more permanent form? We pulled that together into an infrastructure development bill, which was published for comment early in 2013. Public hearings on the new draft bill in 2014 led to amendments to improve the bill, and the National Assembly passed the bill on the 25th of February this year. Now, what is it that the bill fundamentally seeks to address? It has to do with infrastructure, as its name says. And we've identified what we call core infrastructure challenges. The first is the backlogs left by the past. Now, it's sometimes worth noting that even after 20 years of democracy, the patterns of the past stay with us. As an example, we invested heavily in the past in our main cities with very limited infrastructure development in areas like the eastern part of the Eastern Cape, which was a labor-sending area. Now, overcoming that is one of the challenges because, as we will point out later, they require big structural changes. The second infrastructure challenge is ensuring that not only do we get the right infrastructure in all parts of the country, but that they serve the needs of local communities and local enterprises. You create infrastructure that can only be used by large companies, then you continue a pattern in which the economy don't create enough space for emerging enterprises. A third challenge is making sure that your core economic infrastructure, energy, communications, rail, road, water, sanitation, that those are put in place. And the fourth one is to do all of this while keeping it affordable. Our experience over this period since 2011 is that the PICC has helped with improving planning, coordination, and monitoring of infrastructure, and that it's become a key tool that we can reach our common national objectives. In other words, helping to achieve the vision of a developmental state. Now, that's the positive story. But it's a central problem. Many of our projects do not deliver on time, nor within budget, or they have very limited developmental impact. And there are many reasons. We've just highlighted a few reasons here. Red tape, where there's endless form filling and procedures to be followed. Lack of coordination between the three spheres. Big challenge, so things fall between the cracks. And it's not always a problem of one sphere. You can't say the problem lies at provincial level. On some projects, the problem may lie with a national sphere. In another one, it may be with a local sphere. In a third one, it may be with a provincial sphere. There are silos in government. Departments are often structured as closed entities with very little coordination between them. There's lack of integration between our infrastructure systems. Slow actions by bureaucrats, people sitting on applications for long periods. Litigation, endless court cases by people who lose a tender or unhappy about one or other part of a thing, an environmental issue, that just keeps us in court rather than on the construction site. Corruption. Corruption in tenders and in projects that increase costs means, in some cases, shoddy workmanship, so you have poor quality. There's a limited focus on localization and jobs historically in our infrastructure, and an inability to identify and mobilize effectively to get different parts of the state to work closely together, to focus on what we call strategic projects, your big ones, the things that really makes a difference. So let me give the committee an example of what I mean. If you look at the screen, what you'll see there is a grid showing a transmission line that Eskom wanted to erect. Now, all they needed to do here was to get this big tower erected and then basically pull the line from tower to tower and get the energy flowing through. So it's not a very sophisticated project. It's a relatively simple one. You've got to put a steel tower up like this, a couple of them sequentially, and you've got to string your electricity cables. It took 12 years. If you look at from here, where the red dot is, right across till there, 12 years. This is where we came up with the idea from Eskom. This is where we delivered it. 12 years. And the reasons we've identified that you'll see now on the screen, environmental impact assessments, appeals, expropriation, all of that, took up to 6.5 years. And we've identified all the other challenges and problems. So they point to, historically, challenges in planning, challenges in tight implementation, and an open-ended process in which no one felt compelled to put deadlines and time frames. The next slide deals with the issue of cooperative governance, and I want to make the point that just about every major infrastructure, any one of them, in some or other way, involve more than one sphere. You don't really have key infrastructure that is only in one sphere. And that's why the Constitution, on the one hand, provides for a division of competence. It indicates where a competency lies, either concurrent or competence of a particular sphere. But it also provides for cooperative governance, that it's not 9 countries that occasionally meet to talk to each other. It's one country with 9 provinces and a number of municipalities, and that these 3 spheres are really part of an integrated whole that must be designed to deliver to the needs of South Africans. This bill, Chairperson, this bill is about how to facilitate that cooperation, how to get parties to work with each other, the 3 spheres of government, to work with each other. That's really the heart of this bill. If you really, in one single sentence, want to look at it, it is designed to get that going. Not only that, but that is the essential part of it. Now, let me give some examples of the interplay. Take, in the first case, on the left-hand side, an instance where you have exclusive powers. So you may ask the question, well, some powers are exclusive to a sphere. Why do we need a bill, a PICC, and so on? So let's take the example of provincial roads. Of course, it falls within the competency of a province. No question about it. But that road has to link up with the national road system. It can't be a road like the bridge in Cape Town that goes nowhere. Well, there are a large number of people who live in Kandla, and I would encourage the Honourable Member to go and visit them. Millions of people in rural areas need roads, they need water, because when you provide a road, you also need to provide other methods like water, like sanitation and so on. So, but when you build a road, you can also say, but we're now going to dig up earth here. Can we not also lay pipes here? Can we not also do electricity transmission lines? Because we're going to be getting teams of workmen and sometimes women working in this area as constructionists, diggers and so on. So I think in that illustration, even though this falls within the competence of one sphere of government, you can only realize the benefits to society if the three spheres work with each other. And that's where we've got, and I'll talk later about the strategic integrated projects that bring the spheres together on a specific project like that. What about concurrent powers? Let me give the example of education, and I know the Constitution excludes tertiary education, but education excluding tertiary is a concurrent power. So let's say we want to build a school in Mthatha. It's a mud structure at the moment. We want to replace it with a proper school. So now, not only is this a concurrent power, so in reality, I went to a school in Libodi in the Mthatha district municipality, where Department of Basic Education, the national department, had built a school. But now that has to be integrated with the school planning of the province, so that the province don't also build a school very nearby. But even more importantly, when you build that school, you need sanitation and water. There must be taps in the bathrooms. You need ICT so that the kids in the rural areas can access the world's knowledge stores through the internet. You need energy. You need electricity coming to that school in Libodi. All of that, and they are stretched across three spheres, these responsibilities. So what happens at the moment is a official from the Department of Basic Education has to phone and try his best or her best to get everybody to cooperate. So maybe water cooperates, but let's say energy don't or Eskom don't cooperate. And you have the reality that we have in many parts of the country. You've got a beautiful school, you've got no electricity. And I'm sure members have seen that. Or you've got great school, you've got electricity, but you've got no sanitation. So that's what integration is about. So whether it is exclusive powers or concurrent powers, the argument for, the motivation for integration is so compelling. Provinces benefit, local government benefit, national government benefit, when you've got a system of integration. What's been our experience with the PICC? In February 2012, Cabinet adopted the first National Infrastructure Plan. It identifies 18 what we call SIPs, Strategic Integrated Projects. And a SIP is a cluster of projects that we've prioritized. They connected in some way or the other to each other. And they cover all the kinds of infrastructure that we have. Let me give the example of SIP 1 very briefly. Or shall I use SIP 3 since I've spoken about Mthatha? Let me use SIP 3, okay. In SIP 3, on the eastern part of the Eastern Cape, we've got a challenge. How to unlock economic opportunity for people. How to avoid the area being simply a labor sending area where men leave and sometimes women leave the district else to go elsewhere in the country to go and work, coming back periodically. So agriculture is key. So we're going to build an Umsumvubu Dam. But when you get water and people are now growing their crops and they're moving from survival activities to small-scale commercial farming, they must sell. You're not going to consume all of your crops. Go sell it. Now we've got the problem of roads. Rural communities with no roads. Rural communities not connected to the neighboring road.
rural communities that don't know how to get their products efficiently to the markets where people will really pay for it. So we looked at it and we saw the key is the end to Wild Coast Highway. It is quite a challenge to drive from East London to Durban. By rerouting the N2, you can cut 2 hours of the travel time. But more importantly, you can connect rural communities. The bridges that you need to build will mean that people in neighboring areas separated by a river can actually begin to trade with each other. But then there's Umtata, which is the center of that part of the Eastern Cape. Its airport was really quite limited. So what we did was we revamped the airport. New runway, new airport building. Not all of the work is complete, but the runway and the airport building is complete now. We're doing the fencing to make sure that the cattle don't become wardens on the runway when the aircraft is about to land. Now, that's economic infrastructure. But we also need health, because now people are going to be getting much more economically active. You need to have a modern, proper system. So we're building a clinic in Mvezo. You've got to build schools. So once the kids leave the schools, what are they going to do? So you've got to build a FET college campus in Lusikisiki. So there, I've just given a couple of examples to show how things are connected. Now, obviously, all of them will need energy. So we need to ensure that the transmission lines bring energy to that part of the Eastern Cape. And then on the western part, there are a range of other areas, the Kucha area, the port of Nguha, the transshipment hub, the manganese terminal that we want to develop so that manganese coming from the Northern Cape come down and is processed in the Eastern Cape rather than sold raw to other parts of the world. Now that's a SIP. That SIP can't be run by national government alone. It's fundamentally integrated into the vision of the province. But neither can we give it to the province and say you run with it, because so many of the functions and responsibilities lie with national. Think about any of these examples I've given. So, and then if you think of the districts with health and so on, they have got to be integrated in this thing. So the SIPs is the place where you get integration of a lot of the work of the PICC. We've designated public agencies to coordinate the SIPs, and we've seen a rise in public investment over this period. It's now about 7.3% of GDP, and it's in an upward curve. The PICC has also established a system to ensure quarterly monitoring and evaluation of progress on SIPs, and it intervenes to support progress as required. So we have a problem, for example, with the water system in Grahamstown, Makana. So we'll send a technical team, and we'll go and assist that municipality to find out what the problem is and how to fix that. We've learned a lot from our past experience, the Gautrain build, what went wrong, what went right, the 2010 Soccer World Cup build, what were the lessons, the airport revamp, what did we learn? And we've taken all of those lessons and we've distilled it into the infrastructure development build. The build does not create new structures. It takes the structures that we've put in place over the last couple of years and it gives them greater form, statutory form, now that we've stress-tested them over this period. So we know now what works, what doesn't work. We've abandoned some things that we experimented with on early that just didn't give us the return. It was too bureaucratic, and we've got a simpler system now. What has been the experience of the PICC? I'm not going to spend much time here, Honorable Chairperson, because I think increasingly this is a story that everybody is beginning to tell. It's a story that we think all members of the NCOP can tell, the good story. 180,000 direct jobs are being sustained through our infrastructure build program. 320 new schools have been built in those 5 years, many in rural areas where they're replacing mud schools. 10 new hospitals built, in this administration 10,000 beds for university students completed in this 5 years. Two new university build programs have started for Northern Cape and Mpumalanga, and I've just come from a press conference now where Minister Nzimande was saying what the enrollment is for this year at the two new universities. 12 new campuses where FET colleges are about to start construction. So in short, the biggest university FET build in at least the last 30 years. 30,000 kilometers of fiber optic cable for broadband. Two new large dams built in Limpopo. This is massive structure. Those of you who read the City Press 2 weekends ago would have seen this massive photograph in City Press about this very large dam. That's the Whip Dam. And the Spring Grove Dam in KwaZulu-Natal, taking water off the Mooi River and feeding it into the system. Those two are bringing 126 million cubic meters of new water into our water systems. Big new water pipelines that cover industrial users. Waterworks treatment plants that we've completed that brings 176 million liters of drinkable water every day to our people. If you look at what we've done in the 5 years, you could say it's roughly, it's almost equal to a glass of water a day for every person in sub-Saharan Africa. This is just the new water, drinkable water, that we've brought into the system through treatment plants and so on. We've started with construction on the first large new rail line since the 1980s in Mpumalanga. A major program of construction is underway in the urban centers, Rea Vaya in Joburg, my city in Cape Town, the development of a similar system for Tswane, Rustenburg, Etekwini, Nelson Mandela Bay. And I must just take a short pause here and tell the story we were telling in the press conference earlier. City Press, this past week, is a coincidence that I caught them twice, did a competition. They took 3 journalists last week. They took them to Tokoza Park. And they said, take a race to Media Park. Gave them some money, you're on your own. The first person jumped into her car. The second person jumped into a taxi. The third person jumped into a Rea Vaya bus. The person in the car took 29 minutes. To get there. The person in the taxi took 70 minutes. 70. The person in the Rea Vaya bus took 32 minutes. Virtually the same as the car. If you take into account that with the car, the journalist still had to park and so on, whereas you just walked from the station to where you needed to go, the journalist said there was roughly 1 minute difference between the car and the Rea Vaya. And then we calculated the carbon emission. And Rea Vaya was the greenest form of transport. And it was cheaper than the car. And as the journalist said, you could read your book and play with your cell phone while you were there. You couldn't do that if you're driving a car. Now that story illustrates from an independent source, journalists, not government people, how many of the infrastructure interventions are transforming the lives of South Africans. And so when we say there is a good story to tell, it's these kind of examples. Not everything is coming out perfect, accepted, but there are many instances where lives are being transformed by infrastructure. I'm going to skip the detail of the 3,200 kilometers of new transmission lines. I'm going to just simply make the point that in this 5 years, connected 1 million extra households to electricity. But I can't resist telling this story, Chairperson. The first municipal electricity, in other words, electricity that at a local level is given to a household, was instituted in South Africa, introduced in South Africa in 1892, actually 1890, but some of it came in to households in 1892. From that day until the dawn of democracy, more than 100 years, only 5.2 million households were connected. In the period of the democracy, in other words, less than 20 years, because we took our figures from 1996 up to 2011 with the census, more than 7 million additional households were connected. In other words, in less than 20 years, the democracy did better than 102 years of apartheid and colonialism. And it's that that we see also in other areas like sanitation, like water and so on. Again, we haven't done it universally, so there's gaps. There are places where people legitimately are unhappy with the fact that they don't have it. But overall, what we're seeing here is a huge rollout of infrastructure. So, Lord Eaters, 5 years ago, when we went to vote in April 2009, there was not a single solar water heater on a single house in a township. They were in some wealthier suburbs where people were very green conscious. Individuals would have had it. Now, there's not a single province that can say we don't have solar water heaters on many households in our province. So that's this administration's story that we think lies behind what we're doing. Power stations, trains, coaches, buses, all of those are part of what infrastructure is doing. So take the buses. Joburg bought all of its buses 4 years ago from Brazil. Today, Joburg is required to assemble its buses locally, and 80% of the bus body has to be manufactured locally, because we've introduced a national policy guide on that issue. Cape Town has to do the same. So that's, I think, the background to what we've achieved. Now, having achieved that, we still feel there's a lot more to do, because the fact that we've got a good story to tell doesn't mean that there are not also challenges that we must respond to. And so this bill will help to lay the basis for the next administration to significantly scale up infrastructure delivery to all parts of the country. And so I'd like to go next to what the bill does. First, the bill is intended to speed up and improve service delivery, implementation of economic infrastructure, and maximize development. And how does it do this? First, it establishes in law the structures of the PICC to provide for executive authorities in all three spheres of government to meet on a regular basis, to say, look, we're not going to just meet at social functions. We're going to now meet on a systematic, disciplined basis to talk about infrastructure. Secondly, it provides for strategic integrated projects, SIPs, which I've spoken about earlier, that connects and aligns a number of catalytic projects that make up the National Infrastructure Plan. Third, it sets timeframes for approval of regulatory authorizations. That if you are a civil servant in a city, in a province, or in a national department, and an application is brought to you, there are timeframes. Not only is there timeframes for you, but there's timeframes for every other official, so that if we want to build a power station, and we need 10 or 15 or 20 types of authorization, they all work to the same time frames, that you know everybody is working hard at seeing, does this project deserve to get the approval? And if it does deserve to get the approval, we will do it within these prescribed time frames. Fourth, it sets out processes of coordination that require the different agencies in government to work together. And I've given examples earlier how you can't do a single thing. You can't even build a school without coordination of sanitation, electricity, water, internet access, building materials, and so on. So we bring that together in sub-steering committees. They're really very important in the bill, because that's where your officials across the three spheres will sit and work.
Fifth, it provides for the PICC to expropriate land required for infrastructure development, but it makes that subject to the Constitution and the Expropriation Act. And it also provides that if the PICC is going to expropriate land on behalf of another entity, like a province or like a municipality or so, then it does that in consultation with that other entity. Sixth, it sets out the mechanisms through which developmental targets can be set for every major infrastructure project. So if we're going to build a new port in Etiquini, or we are going to build a new hospital in Soweto, then we then can say, how many young people must we employ? How many artisans or engineers must be developed through this project? How do we use that project to green the economy? How do we ensure broad-based empowerment, including women's empowerment, in the process? How do we industrialize? What local content does this project need? Now, having said those six things, I want to make the point that BOLD does not change the responsibility of accounting officers or authorities, or the route for fiscal flows. I know this committee won't normally look at the detailed budgetary issues, but because budgets also flow to provinces, I want to make this point. This bill won't change that. Money still flows to where it currently flows. So if we're going to build the Umzimvubu Dam, that money goes to Department of Water Affairs. If we're going to do a school, not through what they call the ACD program, but through the normal program, that money will go to the Eastern Cape. If we're going to do the Mvezo clinic, that money will go to the municipality. So that doesn't change. And that's an important thing, because the accountability for the money remains there. It means that every national department is still accountable to Parliament for the spending. Provinces are still accountable to the provincial legislature for their spending. Our job in the PICC is to integrate, to connect, to make sure these things speak to each other. The core aims of the legislation is to empower the state to deliver to the needs of citizens, to strengthen coordination, to speed up delivery. But the bill, we're very keen to ensure that the bill does not create unnecessary grounds for litigation and legal review. So we've taken time, both in the original formulation of the bill and in the changes that came through the public participation process, to ensure that we don't put anything unnecessary in the bill that can be the source of litigation. We've not packed all of our policy goals into one law. All the other laws still stay on the books of Parliament, so to speak. In other words, they still have legal effect. Here we've gone for fairly focused, specific things that we're trying to achieve. And we're not seeking to put in new consultation processes or standards that are already covered by existing laws or regulations. So we're quite clear that this is not an omnibus law that covers everything. It's an infrastructure law that is quite focused. The objectives of the bill, it's a legal mandate for the PICC and its structures and for the maintenance of the National Infrastructure Plan. It's to identify key development elements, to clarify the role of departments and agencies, to establish procedures and structures, to set out time frames and planning. In part one, the bill deals with definitions and objects. I'm sure committee members would be very familiar with it. It establishes the PICC, it identifies the SIPs, it aligns resources across the state, it provides for the appointment of ministers as chairpersons of SIPs, steering committees to be the technical support, establish processes and timeframes for implementation, and ensure that infrastructure promotes developmental aims. So we've captured that as the objects of the bill. What does the bill not do? because sometimes it's important to clarify as much what you do, also what you're not seeking to do. The bill does not set new substantive standards for infrastructure. So it's not dealing with a technical standard of a building. It does not dictate specific projects outside of the SIPs. So there'll be hundreds of other smaller infrastructure projects. Unless they're brought into a SIP specifically, they're not covered by this work. It does not permit unilateral national government decisions. So it creates structures of consultation, even where national government has competence. It's required now through the PICC processes to be talking to the other spheres. It does not change standards for environmental approvals. It's not a new standard. It does not permit unfair expropriation. It does not change the responsibility for infrastructure delivery from one sphere or functional department to another. And it does not establish a costly new bureaucracy. How does it get structured? There's a council led by the president with ministers, premiers, metro mayors and SALGA. There's a PICC management committee made up of ministers and representatives from the other spheres, and they oversee and lead the process. There's a secretariat made up of ministers and deputy ministers. They do the day-to-day work. There are sub-chairs and forums of executive authorities where MECs and mayors will get involved. There are steering committees where the officials will get involved, and there's accounting officers. So what this is, it's bringing people together rather than creating a new bureaucracy. It's getting the bureaucracy to talk to each other and to work with each other. Now this bill deals with a tiny part of the project pipeline of the PICC when it looks at time frames. So if you look at this screen, if we want to build at Umsumvubu Dam, the project conception has to take place. Now, of course, with Mzumvubu, the project conception already took place in the 1960s. Just nothing happened after that. So, this is now where the real work starts. This is where we've now got involved and made sure that pre-feasibility, the feasibility, and all of the technical work around planning takes place. Then you need regulatory approvals. You need to apply for various permissions, and you have to create an environmental impact assessment. And this year, this particular green block is where the bill focuses on the time frames. Then you've got procurement, the technical specifications, the tenders. You've got to bring the equipment in either from factories in South Africa, or if it's technology we don't have, you've got to bring them from elsewhere in the world. Then you've got to start building. And finally, you've got to complete your project and integrate it. So with the dam, you've got to get your irrigation systems, got to make sure that they go to local communities and so on. Now, the reason I've raised this, honorable members, is to show that if you look at Schedule 2 and you see the time frames there, that is just this little bit. And that's why infrastructure takes so long, because we've created all this regulatory and other requirements here, and then there are all the other inherent requirements of infrastructure. So our job is to make this whole thing go faster. And that's what we're working on the PICC. There are some specific provisions. I'm going to just highlight some because members are familiar with the bill. The one that I want to particularly highlight is that our definitions ensure that a SIP encompasses public infrastructure. And we've defined it widely as publicly owned, PPPs or concessioned infrastructure. That's important because it means that we have a fairly wide definition of public infrastructure, and we do provide that private infrastructure can become part of the SIP with the consent of the owner of that infrastructure.
But in this bill, we're focusing on the public infrastructure. We want to get that fast-tracked. Then we've introduced the clause 2.2 in the bill that reads, and it's particularly relevant to provinces, so I want to highlight it. Any person exercising a power in terms of this act must do so in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution, and in particular with the functional competences of the different spheres of government. So every single clause of the bill, doesn't matter which part of the bill it is, when the person who is going to exercise that clause does so, they must know it must be fully compliant with the constitutional setting out of the functional competencies of each sphere. So no person can ride roughshod over the competence of national government or provincial government or local government. And that's why we've given it this overarching status. Clause 3 provides for the structures of the PICC, and it puts in place a council as the lead structure, that's the existing practice, and it provides for who are the members of the council. It provides that the president chairs the council, which he does currently, and it gives an indication of the importance we attach, and will continue to attach for some years still, to getting infrastructure right. And the council ensures that all spheres have a voice in infrastructure planning and prioritizing. So it's not a national government. The PICC is not national government. The Infrastructure Development Bill is not national government. It's government. It's the integration of the three spheres. We highlight Clause 4, which deals with the functions of the PICC, on the National Infrastructure Plan, on SIPs, on infrastructure projects and development goals, on the obstacles to implementation, and on maximizing our national development outcomes. On coordination and planning, Clause 4.4 strengthens the framework for cooperative governance around infrastructure, and I wanted to just pause here for a moment by drawing your attention to the words there. It says every organ of state must ensure that its future planning or implementation of infrastructure or its future spatial planning and land use is not in conflict with any SIP implemented in terms of this act. So let's now begin to just integrate our work, that our SIPs, our IDPs, our provincial plans, they begin to talk to each other. And then it deals with the fact that this does not derogate from any power of a province or municipality to implement any infrastructure project outside of a SIP, and any dispute, there's a dispute mechanism. Clause 5 gives the PICC or minister whom it designates the right to expropriate land in the public interest as well as for a public purpose. That's language from the Constitution. So we've made the whole thing subject to the Constitution and by applying the Expropriation Act of 1975. There's been extensive jurisprudence that's been developed and procedures out of the 1975 Act, but it's got its weaknesses. So the executive is currently preparing an Expropriation Amendment Bill that will complement the Infrastructure Development Bill. Clause 6 empowers the President to establish the Management Committee, and the MANCO acts on behalf of Council between meetings of Council. The SIPs, Clause 7, establishes the criteria for designating a SIP. It's basically, it's got to be nationally important or large or included in the National Infrastructure Plan. A minister chairs a SIP, so we've got 18 SIPs. We have Minister Nyesi, for example, chairs SIP 1 around integrating work in the Limpopo area. Minister Gigaba would chair SIP 2, dealing with the integration of our corridors between Durban and Free State and Gauteng. subsidiary would be chaired by Minister Nkwinti, which deal with the Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, KZN integration, and so it goes. So you have different cabinet members taking responsibility way beyond their functional line responsibility, so that we get them to begin to integrate the work of different departments. Clause 8 provides that the PICC must determine if a SIP is put out to tender, or let me put it this way, that if the PIC determines that the SIP needs to be put out to tender, let's take this as the Umsumvubu Dam. We say, okay, we must put the dam now out to tender. Now, you can't just ask the Department of Water Affairs to do the tender. You also have roads that have to be built. In fact, you've got to get the roads in place before you build the dam, because you need a road for the trucks and for the earth-moving equipment. You need, there's going to be a large number of people working there for a number of years. You need housing for them, you need schools for their children, you need clinics and so on. So many different accounting authorities at national, provincial and local level will have responsibility in the PFMA for each of that. All we ask in the bill, all that the bill does, it says PICC gets a minister to write to all those accounting agencies and say to them, please publish your part of the tenders by the state in national newspapers. So that you don't have, we get everything done from Department of Water Affairs, but the road don't get put out to tender. And so we've got a successful tender for the development of the dam, but the trucks can't get there, because there was a delay in getting the tender for the road sorted out. So just integrating. So that's what that clause deals about. And I wanted to specifically draw that to the attention of members, so that in the discussion it's clear what we seek to do. So we're not taking over responsibility for tenders nationally. We're simply requesting that the tenders be advertised in a coordinated manner, so that each part of a project gets done. Next, Clause 9 establishes the Secretariat of the Commission. It's provided for that it gets chaired by the Minister of Economic Development. It comprises relevant ministers, deputy ministers, as determined by the President. So that's your structure that meets on a day-to-day basis. We basically meet roughly every week, and sometimes on 3 or 4 hours' notice. There's a challenge we have in an infrastructure thing. We send out a message immediately. The team meets 4 hours later, discusses it, makes a decision, and it's carried out. So it's a very hands-on structure that is not, that doesn't meet periodically. It meets regularly. Next, under Clause 10, we provide for the Secretary to designate a SIP steering committee, and the SIP steering committees are the real powerhouse of the PICC. That's where you bring in all of your departments, all three spheres of government, basically anyone who has decision-making power or operational power on a SIP. And their job is to say at one go, look, this, if you want to build this dam, this is the regulations you need to comply with. This is the financing challenges. This is the geological issues around the land there that you need to take into account. So they sit with each other, looking at each other, drinking a cup of tea in each other's presence, rather than what we have at the moment. Everybody sits in their own office and think only of their little function, and they don't talk to each other and they don't integrate. And then the rest of the slide indicates who are the Construction Industry Development Board is brought in, and accountability for each of the separate budget items still remain with the accounting officers. Clause 13 includes rigorous provisions to prevent conflict of interest. You can't be the head of this steering committee and have your brother also being involved in a project. So we identify family members, parents, children, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, first cousins, and life partners. You should
not forget life partners, and failure to declare conflict of interest, we deal with very, very severely in the bull. You can go to jail. You can go to jail. So it's an anti-corruption clause because we recognize that this infrastructure program must deliver to the needs of our people, not the needs of individuals who want to skim off money for themselves or their families. Clause 14 and 15 establish procedures to ensure that processes to implement the SIP are done expeditiously, are done effectively. So whether it's a license or it's a exemption or an approval or an authorization, they're all covered. Clause 16 provides for SIP procedures and resourcing. 17 promotes a more coordinated and efficient application with a time frame in Schedule 2 to the bill. So we say in Schedule 2, as you'd have seen, what the time frames are. Clause 18 provides for SIPs to take advantage of the full range of environmental management instruments under NEMA, and DEA, Department of Environmental Affairs, have already introduced strategic environmental assessments for the SIPs. So instead of you doing every project separately when you've got, you know, 40 or 50 projects in SIP 1, you now can look at what are the cross-cutting environmental challenges. Can they be covered together? Can we do interventions that can mitigate? And so that means we're speeding up processes whilst paying absolute and proper attention to the environmental issues. And that is a big innovation because it means that instead of each application being looked at only in itself, you also look at the aggregate impact on the environment. And that means that we can have a program that's environmentally sustainable in the long run. We don't run out of water in an area because we overdeveloped it and local communities then don't have water in their taps. And at the same time, we can do all of this in a planned and expeditious way. Monitoring and guidance. Clause 19 requires the minister to report regularly to the council and the MANCO. Clause 20, the minister can delegate powers. Clause 21, the minister acting with the commission, consulting with colleagues, can publish regulations, set guidelines or targets for developmental goals of the society, like industrialization, like the green economy, like skills. None of these guidelines can override the main legislation of the state or of the society, but they can indicate how it will apply to SIP 1 or to the Umsumvubu Dam. Clause 22 contains transitional provisions, and Clause 23, the short title and commencement date. The bill has three schedules. Schedule 1 defines the scope of the Act by saying the kind of infrastructure that can be included. It doesn't mean every one of those are always included, but it means it's an illustrative list of the kind. Schedule 2 provides the time frames. The time frames are clear, but we have provided in the bill that if we need more time for public consultation, the relevant executive authority can authorize it. So for everything else, we're quite tough. We're not allowing for extensions of time, except for public consultation, where obviously we need to make sure that we are able to take into account the views of communities and the society more broadly. Schedule 3 lists the 18 current SIPs to ensure that they are maintained when the Act comes into force. There were some useful public consults. The first question that came up was, does the bill supersede the powers of provinces and municipalities? And out of the many points we've made, three that I want to point to is that the bill requires any power exercised under the Act to be consistent with the Constitution. and in particular, not just generally the constitution, but in particular with the functional competencies of the different spheres of government. It provides for provinces and municipalities to be included in the key structures of the PICC, and it helps to support alignment between the three spheres. Won't the bill weaken environmental protection? And we say no, it won't, because NEMA, the National Environmental Management Act, is the standard setter. This bill don't set environmental standards. It requires NEMA to be followed. It seeks to ensure that we deal with things efficiently and without unnecessary delays, but the framework, the policy framework, is in NEMA. And it creates a balance between the environmental and other rights in the Constitution. The third question is, doesn't the bill establish another layer of bureaucracy? And we say the structures of the PICC that we have in place right now are the ones that are provided for in the bill. The PICC won't impose new licensing or authorization requirements. This bill don't say before you can get a water license, you need to fill in Form 53ZA in triplicate. It doesn't have that. Its job is to cut and reduce red tape, not add red tape. The structures are task-based. They can be reconstituted. They can be closed down when the jobs are completed. And their task is coordination, not empire building. Why is it important for provinces? The bill will support better service delivery through provision of infrastructure. Every of the 9 provinces currently know that they have an infrastructure gap. Every single one, all 9. This bill is a part of the toolkit that can be used. The bill provides for all 9 premiers to sit on the PICC's key decision-making structure, chaired by the president. So in one room, we bring the 9 premiers, the cabinet members, your local government leadership. And hopefully we can sometimes lock the door and say, we don't leave here until we've got problem one solved. But that's not in the bill. NECs will sit on sub-executive authority forums, so the chair of every SIP has to consult with executive authorities, and that's across all 3 spheres, ministers, MECs, mayors, the works. The bill will assist provinces to fast-track implementation where their projects require other spheres of government to work with the province, and where big backlogs can be addressed. You know, it's not always national government that complain about provinces. It's often provinces that complain about national government. And this bill is where everybody is in the same room. And we solve the problem here. Where is the problem with your department? Your department hasn't issued this license. Your department hasn't made this money available. So sitting together, we can actually solve the problem as opposed to blaming, which happens when people communicate via letters, emails, and media statements. The bill will promote infrastructure development with a cross-provincial footprint. So in my earlier point, I'm saying if one province has a provincial project, but it requires national support or local support, this bill helps. But not all projects are province-specific. If we're going to do the manganese smelter in the Eastern Cape, for example, we need to start with a footprint of manganese in Northern Cape. So it's a cross-provincial project. You can't do that by just getting one province to do the work. And the bill will ensure developmental outcomes on skills, on job creation, on youth employment, on women's empowerment, all of which benefit local communities. So a province, a provincial premier that looks at the state of their province must want more developmental outcomes, and we create the toolkit in the bill to achieve that. So, Chairperson, I've taken the committee through some slides in more detail than other slides. I think what we have here is a bill that will meet the needs of the provinces, of national government, of local government,
by creating coordination. It does not take away powers, but it does require that the powers must all be exercised in coordination, in alignment, in working together. So I hope that this bill will meet with the approval of National Council of Provinces and with the constituent provinces. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Chairperson, to talk to the members of the Select Committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for that in-depth briefing. Just on a point, I think that the National Council of Provinces has got an advantage, specifically this committee, has got a great advantage of seeing how the SIPs are in operation and what the SIPs would be. Thank you also on your part for the invitation that you have sent us to attend some of these SIPs launches and all that. Members, it's now over to you. Let me see Honorable Mube. Let me see the hands there. Honorable Mguni. Honorable Van Lingen, I see you nodding your head. Honorable Van Lingen. Our premier in waiting from Mpumalanga, Honorable Nyambi, Honorable Abrams. We're not discussing this now, infrastructure. The list will come after your takes on the infrastructure, whether you're GA or ANC, it will come after your take. Honorable Mube.
No, thank you, Chairperson, and thanking the Minister for his passionate briefing. I just want to agree with you, Honourable Minister, that this bid is going to enhance our good story that you are telling. And job creation, youth employment, and the need, meeting the needs of this country, not of a particular province, and meeting the needs of the 9 provinces, which also includes the Western Cape, and eliminate the plain game. What I want to get clarified is on the local content, local market. The your bill is also emphasizing that, and in the State of the Nation of the President, he also alluded to the more local content than importing. So you talk about the 80% local and plus or minus 20 abroad. So whilst it is not talking about the sanctions of any entity nor municipality that may violate the 80-20 and they revert back to say the powers vested in the constitution of the Western Cape, they allow us to go abroad. What will happen? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mube. Honorable Mguni.
Thanks, Chair. You know, it is not in my nature to praise the fish for fishing, fish for swimming. But I would like to thank the Minister for his commitment that he treats the SOP as equal as an NA, even when the issues, I know they are debating and voting in the NA party, has made time to come to the committee and treat us. So I'd like to thank the Minister for that. I just got one question, Chairperson. In case of these coordination, one personal officials use the schedule for the schedule 2 to store things, or use the presidency what is with the Division of Revenue bill, where now municipalities have to apply 2 years in advance for the project to, or that put their plans 2 years in advance for to initiate the project, if they could get a special infrastructure grant. They use such legislation to stall. So some of the issues, you know, to implement this important project. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Fanninger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson, Honorable Minister, I must concur with my colleague from the Free State that you do treat the NCLP with more respect than the other ministers, and we want to thank you for that. We will also see, as the bill goes through the NCLP, whether that respect is a long-lasting one or just a smile. We hope it's going to be a long-lasting one, as it has started off. You know that we're not really in favor of your department as such, and it has been there for three quarters years, so we can't change that. But you refer to a gap in infrastructure in all nine provinces, which we agree with. We agree with that. But when we look at major projects like Madupi and Kusile, it's a departmental inability to deliver as they should. And I have noticed in the current political structures of this government is to appoint layers of people in between to make up for the incompetencies of other departments or people. And my concern here is that this whole bill is not really necessary if the departments deliver as they should. My other concern is that in this bill, the president is in charge of the coordinating committee, but he's not accountable to parliament. So we have not, nothing is happening. If nothing happens, or if we're not happy with anything, he cannot be held accountable for this whole thing. And you must understand that we're beginning to grasp the size of the budget that will be rolled out in the whole project or the 18 SIPs. There are a number of the clauses that we're concerned about. You brushed rather smoothly over EIAs and mentioned that sustainable development is of importance. However, when talking to our colleague from the NA and the Portfolio Committee, it appears that their proposals for sustainable development was rejected. What is exciting is that you recognize that there will be extra time for public consultation, which is good, because it must be like that. But what about extension, or what are the consequences of departments not delivering luck in the case of Madupi and Kusile? What do you do then? I would like to change, and I agree with my NA counterpart, that we should change the name of the bill to Strategic Infrastructure Coordinating Bill, because that's more where it belongs. And then I mentioned that we don't have, the president is not accountable to parliament. But in this bill, there's no parliamentary oversight. Regarding the identification and tracking of the various sub-projects. So that's a couple of the concerns that I have. There are a number. Your clause 5 on the what do you call it, expropriation, there are a couple of weak spots that we not very happy with. Clause 8 says the commission may, it's been changed, the commission may publish by or may by notice in a government gazette. Why may? Why not must? So that everybody knows where we're going and what it's all about, and that people can actually track where we are going. Clause 17 has got issues, and yeah, there are a whole lot. So I know that you've got to go back to the NA and that you have to speak there. My last point is that we are, if we are want to be constitutionally correct, are we not going to interfere on the autonomy of local government and provincial government? I thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Fleming and Honourable Yambi.
Thanks, Chair. Let me join and welcome the detailed, simple presentation that has been done by the Minister. I will not repeat what has been asked, that has covered what I was going to ask, but I'll raise only two questions. I don't know, Chair. At times, if you follow somebody and you have to ask, you are tempted to address some of the issues because we are members of this committee representing different provinces. And if my colleague is saying we don't support the department, so must I be responding and say we are of the view that it was a very good decision by the president to have this department. That is why today we have a bill in front of us that is trying to address the very same provinces that are affecting some of us that are coming from these rural provinces. I have got two questions. The first one, Minister, is in relation to what we'll be getting when we get to our provinces tomorrow. I know that in Mpumalanga, the first question that we'll be asking is in relation to the financial implications of this very same bill, so that I can be able to deal with that question. And I think almost all of us will be better placed because it will be fresh and we're getting the briefing today. Then the second one is the issue of addressing the challenges of rural areas of the that has been caused by apartheid that you alluded to when you started the presentation. I've noted that in terms of the advice that you got from state law advisors, that it's not a matter of must to consult the House of Traditional Leaders. Maybe a little bit of elaboration so that one can have a better sense, because we will be dealing with issues affecting those rural areas where we have these traditional leaders. Why there is that view that there is no need to do a consultation of the House of Traditional Leaders? Those were the only two questions. Otherwise, the examples that were given to us are very clear, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Nambi. Honourable Evans.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and I'd also like to echo my colleagues in saying thanks for the presentation and for your presence, Minister. Thank you very much. I have been covered largely. I'd just like to ask one question. The 180,000 jobs, direct jobs, sustained, how sustainable are those jobs? How many people are permanently employed? And then also you've mentioned quite extensively about the job creation, but I don't hear you speaking about people with disability. Can you tell me how they also benefit? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. One welcomes the presentation of the Honourable Minister. But I just want to check on page 6, Honourable Chair, under what the bill seeks to achieve. A lot has been mentioned in that page. And coming to bullet number 5 and 6, I don't see anywhere where the bill speaks about penalty with regard to those who will be doing poor quality jobs and with regard to those who will be delayed to can complete
the job, and with regard to also those who take too long with the applications. I think it's
Honorable Pakati is a special delegate from the Eastern Cape. He's a member of the Eastern Cape Provincial Legislature. But as the nature of the NCOP is, that special delegates are also allowed to talk, ask questions, and vote in committee meetings as well.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the according me the privilege to express a view on the matter. But I would like to welcome the detailed presentation by the Minister, particularly on the succinct role of provinces. I think I'm very comfortable with that, Chair. I felt I should raise the matter.
So already we've got, we can take it, we've got one vote from the Eastern Cape province already, with our final mandate. But let's not put the horse before the cart here. Minister, over to you.
Chairperson, I thought we must always put the horse before the cart.
Sorry.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you very much to the honourable members for both the very warm comments, which I really appreciate, and for the comments that they've made. Of course, my participation in here is not a favour to the NCOP. In the Constitution, the NCOP has a very particular and important role, and it represents the way in which our democracy is structured. So it is my responsibility to be available to the committee, but thank you very much for the way in which you put it. Let me start with the question raised by Honorable Mube about the question of sanctions. It's a matter that Honorable Van Lingen came up, also raised, what are the consequences for non-delivery, and Honorable Kiketsi specifically spoke to the issue. What happens if people don't do what has to be done here? Now, the first thing is that what the bill tries to do, it recognizes that you've got three spheres of governments, you've got to create a system in which three equal spheres work with each other. Because the Constitution don't have a hierarchy. It has specific spheres, it has specific functions, and so on. And a lot of what we can achieve has to be achieved by political coordination, irrespective of which party runs the province. For that reason, the premiers are brought to the table. Because they have the ability to bind their province, which a senior official or an MEC won't be able to do. It means if we in the PICC, if there's a disagreement about local content, the PICC will work through the matter and typically will end up with some consensus, which we would then expect everybody to carry out. So that's the system that we've created at the political level. But we've complemented that by creating a legal tool. And the legal tool is where you can mandate something, where the law would require someone to do something. I'll use the example, a friendly example, of the buses. We use the triple PFA as the law that allowed us to specify that buses have to be assembled locally. Joburg implemented it. Cape Town implemented it. Because it's the law. No one can act against the law if they are a publicly elected office bearer. So the law would be the basis of ensuring that it gets done. And our constitution provides for ways of resolving disputes where any public entity acts in
flagrant disregard of a legal requirement. I think on the issues in this bill that we will find a high level of cooperation from all the provinces, and even given this administration's experience with each of the 9 provinces, on something like local content, everybody will see advantage to themselves. So, again, let me use the Western Cape. They saw advantage to the creation of a bus building factory, I think in Epping. Let me take the example of Gauteng. They saw the advantage of a bus building factory in Springs, I think it is. KZN saw the opportunity, the benefit of a taxi building assembly plant in Ekurhuleni. So the example was used by Honorable Mube around local content, and it was warmly welcomed, and the question was, are the sanctions, if it's not carried out, in reality it would be a legal requirement. But Honorable Van Lingen and Honorable Kekesi's question go beyond the politicians. They also go to the question of the officials. The bill is principally directed at the state. It doesn't put obligations on the private sector, save where the private sector are part of public infrastructure. So this is not a bill that says what you need to do if you're building a shopping mall. That would be covered by the normal laws, but this would be for public infrastructure. Now, let's say an official sits on a permission that they're supposed to give and they don't give it. What will happen? They would be in clear breach of the law, and disciplinary action can be taken. We will have a compelling case to initiate disciplinary action if an official fails to act in accordance with a clear, specific provision of a piece of legislation or regulation. So we've looked at this. We considered whether we should put specific, explicit penalties in here, and we concluded that our toolkit of staff management rules is sufficient if an official fails to hold to any of the requirements placed on them by a law. So we have no concern about the fact that we haven't spelled out. The only sanctions we've explicitly spelled out is in relation to conflict of interest / corruption. But failure to meet a deadline will immediately trigger our ability to use the disciplinary processes. I come next to Honorable Nguni's question, which is a variant of that one, which is, can officials use the time frames in Schedule 2 to in fact delay matters? And we considered the question of time frames because it can always be a double-edged sword. We think we've solved the problem by very explicit and clear drafting that, starting with paragraph 17.2, it says, notwithstanding any other law, the process is set out in Schedule 2, provide a framework and guide for the implementation of any strategic integrated project, but the time frames in Schedule 2 may not be exceeded. May not be exceeded. There's an exception to that, which I'll come to in a moment, but what that means is that these are, generally speaking, the maxima. So an official can't say, but look, the Schedule 2 provides for 30 days for this particular step. I still have 15 days left because that's the maximum. It can't be exceeded. But obviously, in individual circumstances, there's good grounds to do it sooner.
that official can be instructed to do so. Now, the second part is, it doesn't mean every time there's a query, you go back to the beginning of the processes of time. These are cumulative. At the moment, it takes much longer than this. So the net effect is that this will be a substantial reduction. All the main state-owned companies have told us, if we can achieve in practice what we set out in Schedule 2, they'll be very happy, because it would be a significant improvement on the delays that they have. But I also would make the point, knowing that Honorable Nguni would agree with this point, that in the end, a law can only do so much. You need hands-on management to ensure that departments, whether national, provincial, or local, actually do their work, and that we change the mindset and culture of some in the bureaucracy who fail to understand that they only have the power that they have as long as they serve the needs of our people. So we need to complement the bill with a re-energizing of the bureaucracy. They go hand in hand. Honorable Van Lingen, first, thank you for the very positive comments that you've made. And the bill is a fairly considered product. It's gone through quite an extensive process. We suspect when Honorable Van Lingen looks carefully at the bill, she will find much in it that she would be strongly supportive of and would see as valuable to the achievement of the needs of the province that she represents, as I think every other member of the Select Committee will. So let me take some of the specific things. I'm going to spend a few minutes on them. I'm going to take a bit of time on them, in the hope that it can provide a bit more clarity. Let's start with Medupi and Kusile. And I'd like to start with Medupi as the example. What are the delays at Medupi? There are two types of delays. The first type of delays are caused by contractors who appear not to have met the technical specifications. So, who are those contractors? Are they the Department of Public Enterprises? No, they're not. Are they ESCOM? No, they're not. Are they Alstom? Yes, they are. A major Swedish company. Are they Hitachi? Yes, they are. A major Japanese company. So here you have global companies performing below the standards we require in one of the world's biggest coal-fired power stations being built. Medupi, when it's done, will be the world's fifth largest coal-fired power station. It's a complex contract. And incidentally, Kusile will be the world's fourth largest coal-fired power station. So here the inability to deliver is a problem created by private sector contractors, picked up by the public sector, who has to do the quality control. It is to make sure that we actually have welding that can last through the enormous pressure that you place a furnace in a power station. So it's easy, I think, to knock our public entities, but I've not heard too many criticisms of Alstom in the media. And that's where the problem arises. So what are we doing? We're making sure that we begin to build the technical capability in the state to be able to monitor exactly that, and that we impose penalties against companies that don't meet the contractual standards that we've set. And that's what's happening now with the companies concerned. The second kind of problem is when you have loss of production time because of industrial relations challenges. You have a strike at Medupi.
Now, of course, we could ask Honorable Pakati to come and help us there. But aside from that, who is the fight between? Is it the fight with government? No, it's not. Is it the fight with the Department of Public Enterprises? No, it's not. Is it the fight with ESCOM? No, it's not. It's a fight between contractors and their employees. Now, those contractors could be Group 5, it could be Murray and Roberts, it could be Alstom, it could be any of them. We could, of course, if the society and the constitution and our values were different, we could have imposed everything from the top. But we don't. We have a free system, a system of collective bargaining where employees and employers find a way to reach consensus with each other. It's a constitutionally protected right to collective bargaining. We'd like many of those labor problems to be resolved, so from time to time we step in as a state, we've asked the contractors to sit down with the trade unions and develop longer term agreements and bigger frameworks. But we mustn't always assume that because there's a delay, it's caused by the state or by a department. So I think the part of Honorable van Lingen's point that I want to embrace is that there must be consequence for underperformance. But let's assign the responsibility where it belongs. If the contractor is underperforming, then there must be consequences. If there's an industrial relations problem, that the department and the state don't manage the industrial relations of private companies. And it's private companies that build a power station. So that those are not matters that this bill deals with. Those are the contractual issues. But what this bill does is when we see a pattern of problems at AMEDUPI, we can now begin to step in as the state, call the contractors, call the unions together, and begin to deal with the underlying problems. If it's an industrial relations one, if it's a quality control one, we can sit down with Alstom and make sure that there is speedy rectification of the problem. Honorable van Lingen then uses that example of MEDUPI to say the bill is not really necessary if departments deliver as they should. Well, I guess in society, if we were all angels, there would be no need for laws. Any law. No law at all, because everybody would act properly, courteously, respectfully, with due consideration for everybody else. In reality, on our roads we have traffic laws, because we recognize human beings need to have systems where everybody knows, I know I'm a stop because the light is red, I know I can go because the light is green. This bill does the same thing. It assigns a place where every department and across the three spheres meet to coordinate what they need to do. If we ever get to the happy world where everybody naturally does what they need to do, I think Parliament may well find itself without any role and responsibility. But I think we could plan that for a long time so that eventuality won't arise. So in that case, the bill is necessary, because in reality it's complex things that people have to coordinate with each other. Take a simple thing like a school, and I speak from practical experience because I go to the schools. I come to a school, beautiful building, and I went the other day to Honorable Pakati will know the school. It's on the road to Hole in the Wall. Tiny little village. Really tiny little village. And I come there and we've built a beautiful school using national government money. And there's books in the library. It's really, the kids were very enthusiastic. But we didn't have running water. We didn't have running water because there was another part of the state that didn't integrate its work. But when we looked at it to say, okay, is it just an official that's sloppy? No, it wasn't. There were much bigger problems sitting behind that. Including in that case, a court action that was delaying the supply of water. and there was no forum where people could sit down, discuss it, and say, okay, look, can we buy out the contractor that's taking that particular municipality to court because it's a relatively small sum, it's something that can be done in the process of getting the school up and running. There's no integration coordination structures. The bill allows for that now to be embedded in a case like that, so that you have a place where you go to and you resolve issues. So whether I use a small example like that, it's really a micro example, or the example of Medupi, where not only do you need integration in the plant, but why do you have the strikes? Fundamentally, workers are concerned about losing their jobs when the contract comes to an end. That's what it's about. I've sent team members from EDD to go just meet people, not make a big fuss and have a fanfare, just go and meet local community people and just do a site visit and find out what are the problems. And it came out so much there and on the Mokwep water pipeline, we are concerned in a couple of years the thing is going to end. This is our bread. Now, what does the PICC do? What does the bowl do? How does the bowl help? Well, many of the people there are not currently being trained to do anything other than the work that they're doing on Medupi. So now we will mandate skills outcomes so that people have something else that they can do when Medupi comes to an end. But there's something else also. If we know we are going to be building other major infrastructure in Lephalale, as is the plan. Currently, nobody is sitting down. There is no place in the state with a legal and institutional responsibility to say, Medupi will come to an end in 2018, so many workers will be laid off. Can we synchronize this new infrastructure build to begin at about the same time so that workers could move from the Medupi power station to this other infrastructure? Our planning systems don't have that. The bill creates a planning system by creating a coordinated system. Water pipelines, still on Medupi. Medupi is going to need quite a lot of water. There's a pipeline that's being designed now for the water for Medupi. NERSA has agreed it's going to have the offtake, all perfect. But there's no place in the state currently with a legal mandate to say, okay, beyond Medupi, what is the needs of water in the Waterberg? And is that pipeline size the right size? So when we looked at that, we found that the pipeline size that was originally designed was too small. We're going to run out of water and we're going to have to do a second pipeline costing us billions of rands. Whereas we can just widen the pipeline size now and save billions of rands for the state afterwards. The PICC does it. There is no structure at the moment that is responsible for something like that. So I can take example after example to indicate the value that the PICC is currently adding, and that what the bill does, it gives it legal form. Because this is a public institution. It's not a private institution, it's a public institution. Next, Honorable Van Lingen comes to the question of the President as the Chair, and the President is not accountable to Parliament, and if people are unhappy, where do they go to, and that range of concerns. Let me attempt to deal with it as follows. Let's start with the 1 trillion rand that we spent. The suggestion has been there'll be no parliamentary oversight of that trillion rand because it's now in the infrastructure plan. The reality is exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. Every single project that falls under a SIP uses public money. Every bit of public money that comes from the fiscus must be voted on by Parliament. Every underlying project has an accounting officer. That accounting officer reports to a portfolio committee. That portfolio committee is subject to the National Assembly. they report also to a select committee that is subject to the overall authority of the NCOP. So let's go to our example of the Msumvubu Dam. That money won't be on the presidency budget. It won't go into the hands of any individual. It will go to the Department of Water Affairs. It will come in the dwarf budget office. It will be approved by Parliament. There will be accountability to Parliament. So, a SIP 3 won't have a budget worth 15 billion rand that is transferred to the presidency or the president. If it's a 15 billion rand budget for SIP 3, it will go to many different departments. The water one will go to DWA, the school one will go to DBE, the rail one will go to Department of Transport, the airport will go to Transport, the clinic will go to Department of Health, and so on. So in other words, the flow of money from the taxpayer goes to each of the departments that are accountable to Parliament. It's fundamental that accountability remains. That accountability is in no way changed as a result of this bill or the practices of the PICC. But let's raise the broader issue of parliamentary oversight. The Constitution is very clear. Every SIP is chaired by a minister. Every SIP is chaired by the minister. What does the Constitution say? The Constitution say, in clause 92.2, members of the cabinet are accountable collectively and individually to Parliament for the exercise of their powers and the performance of their functions. What does that mean? It means if I chair SIP 5, as I do, I am accountable to Parliament for the exercise of the powers and functions in chairing SIP 5.
Sorry, Minister. Order, members. Order. It's quite important. Mkhabalo, you are getting.
But let's go further. Clause 92.3 of the Constitution says, members of the cabinet must be provide Parliament with full and regular reports concerning matters under their control. So I am the chair of SIP 5. Not only am I accountable to Parliament for the exercise of my powers, but I have a specific reporting requirement to Parliament. And so in the design of the bill, we selected ministers to chair the SIPs, which is where everything happens, because they are accountable to Parliament. We go next then to the issue of environmental impact assessments, sustainable development. And Honorable Van Lingen was concerned that we're skimming over this thing a little bit lightly, and that there were concerns raised in the National Assembly by one of the parties. And what do we say about that? Now, the first question is the bill consistent with our policy and constitutional imperative on sustainable development? And I say unequivocally yes. Why? Number one, there's a clause in the bill that explicitly says any person exercising a power in terms of this act, it's under the objects of the bill, 2.2. Any person exercising a power in terms of this act must do so in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution. So the question of sustainable development and all the constitutional issues around that has to be taken into account. But it goes much further. It has an entire clause in the bill, clause 18, dealing with environmental matters, which says whenever an environmental assessment is required in respect of a SIP, such assessment, and this is the key word, must be done in terms of the National Environmental Management Act. What is the National Environmental Management Act? It is the Act on Sustainable Development. Now, we could have rewritten it. We could have pulled out the clause, or we could simply have said, actually, that bill does it beautifully. Not bill, that act does it beautifully. It's an Act of Parliament. It is the last word on environmental sustainability. Let's endorse it in its entirety. Let's require all work done in infrastructure to be done consistent with that act, NEMA. Through that, we've taken all what is in NEMA and incorporated it effectively by way of policy framework into this. In the same way with expropriation, we haven't listed expropriation must be done this, that, the other way. We've referred to the Expropriation Act. The only time when we listed particular criteria is where the Expropriation Act is deficient, measured against the Constitution, because it's a 1975 Act. So it doesn't talk about in the public interest. So we've had to bring that specifically in as a reference to make it constitutionally sound, because it's vital that we act consistent with the Constitution. So we were asked in the public process by many different groups to put into the objects of the bill many issues. The union movement said they would like decent work as objective of the bill. The environmental movement said they would want environmental sustainability as an objective of the bill. And so we had many other groups. We said there are laws dealing with that. The Labor Relations Act is quite clear. It's a framework that promotes decent work. We don't need to put that in here. NEMA is very clear. It's a framework for sustainable development. We don't have to put it back into this bill. So I think that there may be a profound misunderstanding by the colleagues of the Honorable Van Dingen, and I know she is not the author of this misunderstanding, about sustainability. This is a very green bill. It goes further. It specifically enjoins the minister to develop criteria for the promotion of the green economy. The green economy are all those actions that help to mitigate the effects of climate change. So it's a very green bill. And I dare say, perhaps because of all the pressure of time, perhaps some of the colleagues in the portfolio committee who looked at this had not read the bill in its entirety. And Honorable Van Dingen could helpfully coach them through these things at the appropriate time. Honorable Van Dingen makes a good point, which I appreciate, that the bill provides for extra time for public consultation. It doesn't keep it open-ended. It says an executive authority must make the judgment call. They must do so on a written request from the responsible official, and they must inform the PICC. So that we don't have, I mean, on environmental issues, we've had now a couple of years uncertainty on the N2 Wild Coast Highway. We can't build. Uncertainty. Let's bring matters to a conclusion. If the environmental negative factors outweigh the infrastructure positive factors and we can't proceed with something, let's say we can't proceed. Done. Do something else. But don't take 4 years or 6 years of doing nothing. And so we want to bring matters to a conclusion. Say yes, say no. If the law requires you to say no, say no. And it's not just one project, there's hundreds, so we can move that money to another project. We can find other ways of promoting development. So that's what the bill is about. Honorable Van Lingen has also suggested that the name of the bill should be changed to the Strategic Infrastructure Coordination Bill. Now, at the moment, it's the Infrastructure Development Bill. First, I want to suggest that actually not much rests in a change of name. they basically both talked roughly the same thing. If it was the Strategic Infrastructure Coordination Bill, it would become an act. Its acronym would be SICA. There's probably a better acronym in the world than SICA. No, it's to do with the fact that the bill's name is appropriate. It is about infrastructure development. It's about infrastructure development. And therefore, it has an appropriate name. But surely one can't be against the bill because one thing, instead of being called Jill, it should have been called Janet. One is looking at the substance of the bill. If the bill is fundamentally misleading in that an infrastructure bill is called a, shall we say, a development of railway stock bill, then one can say, look, it's so misleading. The public won't know what it refers to. But there's nothing different between strategic integrated infrastructure and infrastructure development. Honorable Van Lingen was concerned about clause 8, because clause 8 says the Commission may, by notice in the Gazette, designate SIPs for the purpose of this Act and amend the designation of SIPs. Why doesn't it say must? Well, there's a very simple drafting reason for it, which lawyers explain to us when we ask them these kind of questions. If one say the Commission must by notice designate SIPs, you require the Commission to designate even when there may be no grounds to designate. A litigant could come up with a proposal for a SIP, litigate and require the state to do it. May simply in this case means that the Commission has the discretion to decide whether there should be a SIP or not. But having exercised that discretion, it shall publish a notice in the Gazette. We've taken it one step further. We've actually put in Schedule 3 the 18 SIPs. So it may be that Clause 8 would never be actioned, or it may be if it's actioned, it would be in respect of one or two or three other SIPs. So it's not to give the Commission the opportunity to act in secrecy, it's just the drafting language that lawyers use in matters like this. Honorable Van Lingen was also concerned about the autonomy of local and provincial government. I dealt quite substantively with that in my presentation. I could run through those issues again, but I have drawn attention to Clause 2.2, which is as unambiguous a language as one could ever find in a drafting process. You can't be clearer than language that says any person, not the president, not cabinet, not an official, any person, so all of them, exercising a power. It doesn't say a power in clause 5.3 or only in 5.7, it says exercising a power, meaning any power. Every single sentence, line, word, comma. In terms of this Act, it doesn't say Section 5 of this Act, it says this Act. It means Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, Section 4, and so on. Must do so. It doesn't say may do so. It doesn't say must consider doing so. It doesn't say will sometimes do so. It says must do so. In a manner that is, it doesn't say respectful or that has reference to the Constitution. It says that is consistent with the Constitution. Consistent. Very clear. Very explicit language. But then it doesn't stop there, because that would have been sufficient. It then says, you know what, you've got a belt on that's keeping your pants up, like put braces on. Let's just put those braces on. So the braces are, and it says, and in particular, so it draws specific attention with the functional competencies of the different spheres of government. That is really, Honorable Van Lingen, I want to say as respectfully as possible, a clear and explicit setting out of the fact that this bill cannot be used in any way to undermine the autonomy, the constitutionally defined functions of any of the three spheres of government. And it's not done as a gift to provinces, it's done because every law must pass constitutional muster. This bill tries to make sure in a system of three spheres of government, how can we integrate them? How can we get them to work together? That's really what they are about. Now, I've taken this time, Honorable Chairperson, because we did this a little bit more, in a more cursory fashion in the Portfolio Committee, thinking that by just broadly speaking to these issues would be understood, but I accepted subsequently there was this profound misunderstanding by some of the members of the Portfolio Committee about what the bill says. And these are very simple, clear issues. Fortunately, it was only in one case, only one party. Everybody else endorsed the bill completely, all the other political parties. So my appeal would be, having had the benefit of hearing what these things are, can we not get to the point where the concerns are now adequately met? Because we gave them serious consideration, both in drafting the bill, but also in the process of the Portfolio Committee, listening yet again. The Western Cape government made a submission to the committee. The department was given a copy of the submission. We took time, read through it, familiarized ourselves on it, and said, can we support as a department some amendments to the bill to take into account all the legitimate concerns? Even when we got legal advice saying, you don't have a legal problem here, we still said to our lawyers, fine, is there any harm in just tweaking it a little bit to put the braces in? Don't just rely on the belt, put the braces in. And we think we've done a good job, that the Portfolio Committee endorsed the approach. It took into account the views of the public. So I want to contend that we ought to be able to move forward on this issue with broad support, because we have taken those matters into account. More briefly, Honorable Nyambi, the financial implications of the bill, it's relatively modest for provinces. It would mean it's no new officials. So let's start with that. We don't want new staff appointed. It's no new budget for infrastructure purely as a result of this. It means using the provincial budget more effectively. Is there some extra expenditure that will come about? Yes, there is, for flying to a meeting. So just getting those subcommittees to meet and getting the premier to fly to the meetings of the PICC. But those are the normal monies that provincial legislatures budget for, which is part of cooperative governance. On rural areas and not consulting with the House of Traditional Leaders, the Clause 18.1A of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act says, quote, any parliamentary bill pertaining to customary law or customs of traditional communities must, before it is passed, be referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders. So the legal test that is applied is it's got to deal with issues of customary law or customs of traditional communities. We looked at that and we concluded, and the lawyers concurred that in this case this bill does not deal with customs, traditional customs or customary law.
Honorable Abrams asked the question on the 180,000 jobs, and in particular the question of sustainability. Most of these are construction jobs. Construction jobs are by their nature jobs that are project specific. If you don't have a national infrastructure plan, it means when your project comes to an end, the jobs come to an end. But if you have a national infrastructure plan, as we have, at the moment our latest iteration that we shared with Cabinet is a 40-year time horizon. We've looked now at migration, flows of people into the different cities. What will it mean for infrastructure? New cities that would have to be created. Climate change, what will it mean for infrastructure needs? So we've gone quite far into the future. So we suspect we will grow the total number of people in employment. The human beings doing the work will change. Sometimes there'll be more people employed in, say, Lepalali, but when those projects come to an end, it may be KZN grows more. When that comes to an end, Free State may grow more. So it won't be the same people doing the work. It will vary from project to project. But we think this number is going to rise quite sharply over the next few years. So our own internal projections are quite high, and so I'm sure Honorable Abrams would welcome that because it's going to be positive for the different provinces. On the question of people with disabilities, thank you for reminding us of that, Honorable Abrams. Clause 21.1 is one of two places or three places in the bill, but certainly that is one place where the position of people with disabilities is explicitly recognized. 21.1b.5 talks about the minister may, in consultation with the council, make regulations regarding the criteria that must be applied in the implementation of a SIP relating to people with disabilities. And from my memory, there is one or two other places in the bill where the matter is referred to, but certainly this is the key operational area where it is referred to. I have covered Honorable Kiketsi's question earlier. And thank you to Honorable Pakati for the comment. I think it is in the interest of all nine provinces that the bill be implemented as rapidly as possible by being passed by the NCOP and sent to by the President. But I want to make this point that we will come back to Parliament within the next few years with further refinements, because what we're trying to do with this bill is learn from experience. The idea of trying to spend a lot of time developing the perfect thing and not doing anything is what has bedeviled so much of implementation in South Africa. So here what we did was, before we could get a bill, we created a PICC. Normally it would be you create a PICC through a bill. We said, no, let's just begin to work, let's learn, let's make some mistakes, and out of that, let's come to Parliament with a considered product. Now we want to implement this considered product. If some of the expectations we have are not fully realized, we want to be able to come back to Parliament and say, based on experience, we ask honorable members to amend the law in this or that respect. So this is how mature democracies work, that experience guide your lawmaking processes. So in that process, we hope we go fine. Finally, the bill is not very detailed on many issues because it's a framework. It's got to get public entities to get on with the job, not to have lots of reporting and other requirements. So it's a fairly slim reporting requirement in the bill because we want people to be doing the work, but the Minister of Economic Development is particularly accountable for ensuring that there are these quarterly reports to the PICC Council. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister, for that in-depth answering. Honourable Members, I think it is quite clear. Honourable Mube, see your hand was up.
No, the Honourable Minister just what I wanted to raise, he raised it by when he was wrapping it up to say the provinces
when he was working to say the owners are now in provinces to take this before. So I was just I wanted to emphasize the question that at the NCOP we don't necessarily represent our parties, but we represent the provinces. So I concur with you in terms of it is the provinces' decision that will prevail and not parties' decisions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Minister, and DG and the staff. I just want to hear from the legal side, the state law advisor, anything you want to...
thank you, Chairperson. No, I can't add anything to the Minister's sound legal advice that he has given.
procedural advice, Advocate Ali? You're quite happy. Good. So, honourable members, it is now our duty to go and brief our provinces. It's their bill now. So, but the onus is on us to go and brief them what we have heard here in the NCOP, not what the goings were on the NA. So the onus now on us is to go and brief our provinces. I think from the provinces, His Grace, tomorrow is Western Cape and Eastern Cape and Limpopo tomorrow. Thursday it is Mpumalanga, Free State and Mpumalanga. Mpumalanga is Thursday, Free State is Friday. So then we've got the four others outstanding. KZN is also on Friday. They have their sitting. KZN is the only province that got 2 days opening of the legislature, the King and then the Premier. You see how democracy works. Members, nothing from your side. You're quite clear. Our Premier in waiting and the end there. Honorable Nyambi?
Chair, we are fine. We are more than ready to go to the provinces to do the briefing. As Mpumalanga, I know they are ready. They are waiting for me to be there on Thursday.
Honorable Lunguni?
No problem, sir.
Honorable Falinga?
Chair, this is not just like an electronic copy of the presentation, please.
That's not a problem, you can get that. Grace will send it to you, and there is also a hard copy which you can scan and get an electronic copy, but Grace will send it to you. You are quite high technology advanced, Honorable Faminga. Can we move, Honorable Abrams? You'll get the electronic copy. Honorable Abrams? Honorable Pakati? Honorable Nube? Fine. Okay. Minister, parting shots from your side, like they call in Afrikaans, Lupto?
No, just thank you very much. I think some of the questions were very thought-provoking, and I hope we are able to get infrastructure development really stepped up in the next 5 years. It's quite critical for South Africans. And this bill won't do everything. It's one tool in a toolkit, but we think it's quite an important tool, and I look forward to working very closely with all honourable members in the next while as this matter gets piloted through. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, honourable members. We hope to see each other next week, and provinces will do their part as we will do our part. Thank you, Minister. And your department, thanks to the state law advisor, the procedural advice, to our staff, Muscula, and the rest of the staff, thank you very much. To the provinces, Honorable Pakati, and those liaison officers, thank you very much. Please send us through the mandate and the briefings and everything from the provinces. This meeting stands adjourned. Thank you very much.